This is episode 12 of season 5 of The Bad Apples. Hi everyone, my name is Clive 2 and I'm your friendly host. Now I'm sitting out near a street, actually. You'll probably hear traffic, but I'm sort of at a city park. It's just, it's not such a huge park that you can't hear the traffic. So, while it is a really nice day, and I'm glad that I'm out sitting down enjoying the day, there might be a little bit of background noise, so hopefully that's not a huge problem. So if you've never heard the show before, you're probably wondering what I'm talking about. We cover geeky topics in this show, GNU, Linux, just general Unix-y kinds of geeky stuff, and, that's about it. So in this episode, we're going to talk about, a different search engine, an open source search engine, an actual live and running open source search engine, it looks like, Mer and Migo again, and other random stuff. And let's start the random stuff with Ohio Linux Fest, Southeast Linux Fest, and FOSCON. So three big festivals this year that I'm kind of, like, aware of, the sort of community kinds of Linux-y festivals. One, of course, the one coming right up here is Southeast Linux Fest, and I just finished the program guide, doing the program guide for them, using Scribus and Slacker Media, which is my little multimedia pimped-out version of Slackware. It's really just Slackware with packages installed, but just so. Anyway, so I used those systems, a couple of different systems, because I was all over the place. So, Scribus was the main, you know, the one constant in there. Lots of Inkscape stuff, lots of, GIMP stuff. And it was cool. It was really neat. And I've got a lot of observations on kind of, putting together a completely open source, program guide, which I'll go into on some other show. And, not that I haven't done it before. I did that same thing last year. But this time, I don't know, it was kind of interesting because I got to do it on a lot of different systems. I got to just kind of see a different kind of workflow, so I want to talk about that, but not on this show. Point being that Southeast Linux Fest is coming right up. I mean, it's like in 2 weeks almost, for a little bit over 2 weeks maybe under 2 weeks, I'm not sure. It's really, really close. It's June 11th. So whenever you hear this, it's going to be right around the corner. Southeast Linux Fest, it looks like there's going to be a lot of talkers, speakers. It's going to be kind of a big event, and it should be really, really, really fun because just a lot of people go to these things, and you get to meet people who are into the same kind of stuff that you are. You get to meet people that maybe you know via email or IRC. Maybe you don't know anyone, but you get there and you meet someone, and turns out that they wrote your favorite program. You know, it's just, you never really know. So if you haven't registered for it, and you think you might be able to get down to South Carolina for June 11th, 12th, and 13th, or even like the 12th and the 13th, it's probably worth it. You should probably look into that. It's a lot of fun. So that's coming up, and I'll be there. And it turns out that it looks like I scored myself a booth. So I'll actually be there representing Hacker Public Radio with stickers, hopefully, if the stickers arrive in time, as well as Slacker Media, which, again, is my little set of instructional entries, you know, tutorials on how to install different multimedia packages on Slackware and which ones you need to compile, which ones you can just do as a stock install. If you need to compile them, what options should you set? Just kind of stuff like that. Just kind of an optimization tutorial. So it's not really a distribution, but it's certainly a solid set of tutorials. So that would be Southeast Linux Fest. Another one coming up very, very soon, actually on June 19th, is a one-day festival, and as far as I know, this is the first year it's ever been held, and it's called FOSCON, F-O-S-S-Con. And I was doing some, I had Gort and myself, we did some audio promos for that, so that, hopefully you've been hearing it on some shows. I haven't actually been able to do a whole lot of listening or producing podcasts lately, just because of how busy I've been. Moving just, it's not easy. I dislike moving on one hand, but I love moving on the other hand. But anyway, FosCon's coming up. I'll be there as well, speaking and giving a workshop. So if you're closer to Rochester, New York, than you are to South Carolina, then you might want to check out FosCon instead. If you can do both, you might want to do both, because they're really, really, they're going to be really cool events. I know that Southeast Linux Fest was really cool last year, and FosCon I expect to be really cool. So certainly check those out. If you happen to see some guy with blue hair, it's probably me, so say hi, be nice, I'll be nice, probably. And that would be cool. So much, much later in the year, of course, is Ohio Linux Fest, and I'm not going to really get into that because it's so much later in the year. But I was, we were already starting to plan on, for that. And not that I'm actually that much involved with it. I'm just like the secondary graphics guy, meaning that I don't do the fancy, cool graphics that get onto the t-shirts and stuff. I'm just like the guy who picks up the little pieces that need to be done, like web banners and magazine ads. So I'm not, I would say, I'm not intimately involved, but I certainly have been keeping up with what's been going on in the planning committee, so I've been kind of involved with that as well. Okay, so that's the
festival news. Event, FosCon. Place, Rochester Institute of Technology in upstate New York. Date, June 19th. What's happening? Well, here are a few words about FosCon. OpenOffice, Mozilla Firefox, Apache, VLC Player, Pigeon, the free operating system of your choice. Here are some more words. Free. 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 Okay, that was one word, but you get the idea. Go to FosCon.org for more information and registration forms. And now, for one small sound. It's one of my favorites. Listen carefully. Cool, huh?
Okay, so that's the festival news. Let's move on to something I never do, which is distribution news. So, well, first of all, before I get into this, I mean, yes, it's very true that I never, ever, ever do, like, distro releases and stuff like that, and I'm not going to start. There's a great podcast for that already, of course, distrowatch.com or .org, whatever it is, DistroWatch podcast. Go over there, check that out. It's like one of those really professional podcasts, you know, that I really like that stuff, and it sounds professional. It's not like an opinion piece so much. It's more just like, here's the distributions that have come out, here's some tips and tricks, and that's the show. And it's really well done, and it's produced very, very on a regular basis, so that's a great one. If you're not listening to that, you should. And that's over at either distrowatch.com or .org, or maybe both, I don't know. But anyway, I do want to mention two distributions that have come out recently, just because I'm kind of a user of both. So one is, and they both have 13 in their release number. So one is Fedora 13, which came out maybe, I don't know, 2 days ago at the time of this recording. So you should definitely check that out if you're into Fedora, or if you're looking for a sort of say maybe a less customized distribution than something than, for instance, Ubuntu, which, you know, they really seem to configure stuff the way that they want to have them configured in Ubuntu, which, you know, if you're used to that and you like that, then that's great. But if you're not, then you might want something a little bit more close to upstream, I guess. I wouldn't by any means call it like a vanilla distro at all, but it feels a little bit more, I hate to use the word pure, but it feels a little bit more pure. So, I mean, that's one reason I like it, and I like some of the default settings that Fedora keeps, stuff like that. So, you know, if you want to check that out, go for it. It's out. Fedora 13. I'm not really one of those people to push, you know, oh, go upgrade. I mean, I really couldn't care less if anyone upgraded, and I probably won't upgrade myself for a while, because I'm not that crazy about upgrading, usually. Although with Fedora, I sometimes take an exception to that a little bit, because the reason I like to follow Fedora is because they have so many new features in it, and they're kind of like, I don't know, they're a very daring distribution, and I like that about them. So that's kind of like one of the reasons I run Fedora at all. You know, I'm a little bit more haphazard about upgrading my Fedora because, like I say, the reason I run it is so that I can get the latest and greatest packages as frequently as sensible. And I know that you can do rolling distributions that literally have the latest and greatest packages, you know, 5 days after it hits the servers, but I'm not that crazy. Not yet. So Fedora's nice. You get the latest, greatest packages with a little bit of polish, so it's kind of fun. So the other distribution I'm running on all my other machines is Slackware, and you got Slackware 13.1 just came out like a couple of days ago as well. I have not upgraded on that one either, because like I say, I just don't upgrade that quickly, especially on Slackware, because those are all my production machines. If those machines go down, then all the stuff that I'm working on comes to a halt for a long time, and that's not something that I want to deal with. So I'm going to probably just purchase the Slackware disk. I shouldn't say probably. I am going to purchase the Slackware disk, the DVD set, or the DVD rather. It's a one DVD, 32-bit on one side, 64-bit on the other. I use Slackware so frequently, so heavily, that I feel like it's the least I can do to purchase the actual real disk. Plus, frankly, I'm always popping that disk. You know, I'm always reaching for my Slackware disk. And I mean, if you've burned a disk of a Linux distro and you've installed it once, maybe twice, you can kind of, I don't know. So it's a burned disk. It feels right. But I can't tell you how many times I've got the Slackware disk in my hand, installing it on some machine or grabbing a package off of it, or just doing something. So I just figure it would really make sense to have a properly, professionally burned disk that costs money and that gives money back to the project. So I actually meant to do that for 13, but I just didn't have the money on hand when whenever I would go to the site, to the store, to look around, to make a purchase. I just didn't really have the money to spend. So this year I do have the money to spend, and so I'll be doing that. So I look forward to that. That'll be really nifty, 13.1. I could try to go through features and stuff, but I really can't remember what they're doing. All I know is that they're slightly more up-to-date than they used to be. Now, if you are running Current, Slackware Current, which, generally speaking, I count myself among Slackware Current users. I mean, someone says, what do I run? You know, that's like one of the things that I mention, Slackware Current. But, again, like, this past year, I've just been actually doing so much, like, real work. And I mean real work by work external of the Linux file system. It's not just playing around with GNU Linux. It's saying, okay, this is my system, and now I need to get work done so that I can send it out to people. So I've been doing so much of that kind of work that I've really, really needed a stable, reliable operating system, and I've just been I can't afford to run Current. You know, it's just something that I really can't do. And it's a good thing sometimes to step back from all the quote unquote latest and greatest things and really just kind of run what's out there, what's stable, what's supported, and see how those are. Because if you're running Current rather, there's always that sort of, oh, it just broke. Well, that's because I was stupid and I'm running Current. I better, file a bug or spend the next 3 hours investigating why it broke and then determine whose bug it is or whatever. You're very much a tester at that point. But if you're actually running the stable version of all these different software packages, then you get a better feel for what's good and what's maybe not as good. And I guess I'll get into that some other time. There are a couple of things that I have specifically in mind in that regard. So not really part of this conversation though. So yeah, Slackware 13.1's out, 32-bit and 64-bit, and what do they do now? ARM as well, I think. So that is very cool. So check that out if you haven't. I can't tell you how really solid and nice of a distribution Slackware is, but you won't take my word for it anyway. So go back and listen to Chess Griffin's Linux Reality. He speaks very highly of it, and he's right. The man's right. It's a really good distribution. As you may remember, if you've been a long-time listener, that was actually pretty much my first distribution that I actually ran seriously. So it's one of those that you just kind of, after you get the feel for it, start to get settled into it, and it's a smooth OS and a really nice development environment. not that I'm developing applications and stuff. I just mean it's actually got a really sensible and accessible team surrounding it. And it's got, I think it's a really easy thing to get into, integrated into the community with as well. But I digress. That's the distribution news. Now let's move on to something different. Okay, actually, we don't need to move on to something too different yet. We're still kind of talking about distributions, but in a different way. Now, this is a topic that I've covered a lot on this show for some reason, and I guess it's just because this is my platform for recording this show, but I just have to talk about MIMO-related things, or actually, specifically, Nokia N800-related things. So recently, I decided to reflash my Nokia N800 for a variety of reasons. I was having lots of SD card related issues with a different device, actually, but it kind of invaded my Nokia N800 because I started messing around with stuff. So finally, I just thought it might be good to kind of reflash the thing and get it back to a really, really known state and stop messing around with it, since, like I say, it's my recording device for this show. So I did that this morning, actually, and as always, it went well. I mean, it's a really easy process to flash this stuff, especially if you know where to go online, because you have to actually download like the flasher and the binary image of the OS itself. So I did that, went well, happened in like, you know, 10 minutes all told, and that's, I'm talking going out on the web, getting the stuff, flashing. I mean, it was just done so quickly. So that's great. But of course, one of the things that I'd screwed up when I went when I was messing around with things, SD cards specifically, was my MER install. So I'd installed MER on my a little micro SD card, and you know, I ran it off and on. I mean, it wasn't really ever at the point where I could never, you know, I could just eschew MIMO completely and just boot into MER. So I ran it off and on. And so I went back to their site, which is MIMO, I think it's wiki.mimo.org/mer with a capital M, and that is M-E-R. It's a French word meaning the sea, like a landlocked body of water. I went back to their site to download the image and everything, and to my great surprise, it said that MER was now an inactive project. It had seemed to be going, you know, pretty well, so I was really, really shocked, and I read their little notice, and it turns out that they apparently feel that MIGO, which of course is the combination of MIMO and Moblin, they feel that MIGO is actually attempting to do what they were attempting to do in the first place, and so they feel like their project is essentially deprecated. This is interesting, and I wasn't sure what to think about it, but I thought, well, if they're handing this off to MIGO, and MIMO's handing everything off to MIGO, I guess MIGO's the place to go. So I went to MIGO, and while they do have some kind of image that you can download for netbooks, doesn't look like they have an image yet for the what they're calling pocketables. And I guess the pocketables would include the Nokia and other tablet devices. They had a separate image, if I recall correctly, for like phones and things like that. So the N800 is definitely, I'm pretty sure that it's going to fall into the pocketables realm, but there's no download for that yet. So I will be very interested in trying that. I didn't realize that was what was going to happen exactly. I mean, not for the N800, you know, I mean, I really thought MIGO was going to be something for just the N900 and that all the N800 users were going to be stuck on MIMO, Diablo, or MER, and that's just kind of how I saw it. So, I don't know, it'll be really cool if I can get to MIGO on my N800. I would be very interested in trying that, really, very interested. So, my interest in MIGO just, I guess, went up a lot more than it used to be. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about this search engine thing. I've talked a little bit about this on Kernel Panic, Ogcast, and Linux Cranks before that. And it all started, of course, with Google, as everything does, the universe itself did. So there is Google, and Google is a great search engine, and it really does return search results to you when you search for them. And people are hacking it and doing cool things with it, and you know it's neat. And they offer a lot of services that are frightfully convenient, and all that other good stuff. And of course, all this sounds just too good to be true, and it probably is. And we know that they're harvesting data and all this other stuff, which maybe you care about, maybe you don't. I don't know necessarily that I really care about it, like, I mean, passionately, but I also don't know that I want to be a part of it. So, as you might know from this show and other shows that I'm sometimes on, I kind of try to avoid too much Googleism. So, back on Linux Cranks, we'd kind of breached the subject of, gee, isn't there an open source search engine anywhere out there? Like, just a free and open source community search engine. And we thought, well, that would be really difficult to do because it would require a lot of, I guess, bandwidth and probably a lot of space to index the entire interwebs. We kind of figured that it was probably possible, you know, some kind of distributed search engine or something, a peer-to-peer kind of thing or something, or just maybe someone with a data center could just implement it. We weren't really sure the specifics, but, you know, that was, I guess, the result. And so from there, we kind of started exploring other search engines. And we found alltheweb.com, which was basically a cleaner and more minimalistic front end, if I recall correctly, to the Yahoo search engine. So basically someone took the text field from yahoo.com and put it on their page and really pared down their page. You know, instead of going to the frightfully busy and horribly designed Yahoo front page, you just go to All the Web, which is more Google-esque. It says All the Web, it has a text field, and that's it. And then you search, and it's not, the results aren't quite as clean as Google, if I recall correctly, but it's a lot cleaner and better organized than Yahoo. So that was actually a pretty good solution. And for whatever reason, I think I got away from that. I guess probably because of the Yahoo affiliation, or proximity to Microsoft and stuff like that. Got away from that. Mainly because I found another search engine called Clusty, which, again, itself was a front end to a search engine out there done by some other company. Now, recently I went to Clusty.com to do a search or something, and it had been completely rebranded. It's now called Yippie, and it looks a lot different, and I'm not really sure what's going on with it. I went to Yippie or something.com. It looked a little bit odd to me, I decided to keep looking, and I figured the original goal anyway was to find an open source and free or free-ish search engine, and none of the other, you know, All the Web and Clusty were not fitting that order, so I just kind of started hunting around, and I actually stumbled across something on the Apache website. Now, I don't know how well you follow Apache. I know that I don't really, but they've actually got a lot of projects going on that I didn't really realize they had. So obviously they have the Apache web server itself, but then they've got I think it's a lightweight version of it called Tomcat. I think they have something called like Jackrabbit or something. I forget exactly the nature of that one. They've also got actually an XML processor called Apache FOP FOP, which is a it actually takes docbook source files, which is what I'm going to be using it for, and translates them into any number of formats. So if you've done something in docbook, which I'm doing Slacker Media in, all the tutorials I'm porting over to docbook and adding a little bit more material to it for the general audiences. So it takes these XML docbook schema documents and translates them into a PDF, so you can distribute it as an ebook. And I mean a fancy PDF, like with internal links and links that will go out onto the web and stuff like that. You know, it's not just a print to PDF kind of deal. It's a rich, or I guess a hypertext PDF kind of deal. Speaking of hypertext, it also exports it to HTML, so you can put it on the web and post it as basically an HTML book. And now the most recent version also outputs to RTF, apparently. So you've got a lot of different options, all from one source file, which is pretty fancy. And a lot of big projects use DocBook, because you can also output DocBook to a format such that you can integrate it into your software, like as a help document or something like that. So it's widely used. I know Red Hat and Fedora both use it for their documentation. 330 in IRC actually just told me about another like a version of DocBook, I guess, or maybe it's a wrapper around it called Publican that Red Hat and Fedora uses. So it's, you know, they develop entire workflows around this thing. So it's very popular, and Apache FOP is the, I guess, the big free a thing that will translate it out of there. Slackbook also uses DocBook. So anyway, point being, Apache's got a lot of different projects going on, and wouldn't you know, one of them is an open source search engine, I kid you not. So I was just poking around the site, and I stumbled across this thing called Lucene, L-U-C-E-N-E, and it is a search engine that Apache has built, I guess, and it exists. And I thought, wow, this is really cool, because this is exactly what I was looking for. But the problem is, you know, is there an implementation of it? Because I think I'd seen other open source search engines out there on the web, but I couldn't find anywhere on the web that it actually exists as a searchable thing. You know, it wasn't implemented on a public-facing website. And it's similar with Lucene. A lot of the sites that they list on Lucene as being users of Lucene aren't using it for you and me. You know, they're using it for their internal network. They're searching their own databases. Maybe they're a manufacturer or something, and they need to search their stores of data to get the specs of a computer that they made, you know, 10 years ago or something. So it's like Google for their business, if you want to think of it that way. That wouldn't obviously do me any good. So I found a couple that claimed to be internet, you know, web search engines, and I went to them, and all of them had either, they didn't seem to be active anymore, or they didn't seem to be what I thought they were going to be, except one, which was called Antya.com, Antya.com, out of India, I believe, and it is basically what all the web is to Yahoo. You know, they took a text field and popped it onto a page and said, okay, when you type in text, we'll send it to our Lucene search engine. It will search the index that it has created of everything and give you the results back. Now, it's not as minimal as all the web, and it's certainly not as minimal as Google. So that's a downside of this Antya.com site. But the other side of that coin, obviously, is that it is a free and open source search engine, which is really, really cool. I mean, it's a functioning search engine that actually returns valid and helpful results. And you're not going through Yahoo, you're not going through Google, you're not going through anyone, really. You're going through Lucene. Obviously, we're still going through someone's server, and we could argue left and right whether they're, you know, tracking us like Google or whatever. Doesn't really matter. I'm just kind of interested in it on an intellectual level because it's open, it's free and open source search engine. So point is, I've switched my search engineing to that. And one of the easiest ways to do that, of course, is to just simply make that little search bar in your web browser point automatically to Antya.com. Turns out the easiest one to do that on is Conqueror, because that really lets you select your own search engines, and you can add your own with a couple of clicks and a little bit of typing, and it's really simple to get going. You can even assign it a little abbreviation so that in the URL bar you can type, like, for instance, AY colon, and then your text, and then hit return, and it will search Antya, because AY is your abbreviation for Antya, basically. So it's a really nice feature, Conqueror. Reconc makes it pretty simple, I believe, or maybe it was Aurora. One of those two makes it really simple. Firefox apparently need, like, to get a plugin or something to do it, at least as far as I could tell, so I didn't look into that. But I use Conqueror quite a bit, so I figured that's good enough for now. The other ones, I just set my homepage to Antya. Actually, antya.com/pulse.php. It's a slightly less cluttered version of Antya. So, anyway, to get this into your search engine box in Conqueror, for instance, you would click on the little icon that says what you're currently using, which, if it's the default, it's probably Google. Mine was, I think, all the web most recently. But anyway, you click on it, and it brings up a pop-up menu, and the bottom selection is Select Search Engines. That brings up the Web Shortcuts KDE Control Module, which is just a list of all the different search engines that you have access to. And it's an amazingly long list. And if you've never looked in here, you might want to actually look in here, because you might find something that's kind of cool. I mean, it's got All Music Guide, something called Alexa, don't really know what that is, Alta Vista, Ask Jeeves, Astronaut, I don't know what that is, CPAN, so if you're searching, you know, if you're doing a lot of Perl stuff, you've got CPAN right there, Debian Backports, all kinds of stuff, dictionaries, free databases, Google, Google I'm Feeling Lucky, Internet Book List, I don't know what that is, Hotbot, I didn't even know they existed anymore, if I ever even heard of them, Leo, which is like a translator, online translator, just everything you can imagine, and they even have Clusty in there by default, so it's an exhaustive list of search engines, which, you know, you don't really even realize if you've never looked into changing it. So, something to look into right there. Oh, it even has the U.S. patent database. That's funny. So anyway, what you do is you say new, which is a little button on the right, and that brings up a blank form to fill out, and what you need to do is, well, first give it a name, something that you'll recognize. So in this case, it'll be Antia. And then on the search URI, you need to do a little bit of investigation to figure out what that is. Because if you just put http://www.antia.com, and again, that's A-N-T-Y-A.com, then it's not going to, you know, it'll just, if you search something, it would just, in theory, just take you to the Antia.com site. You know, you need to give it some kind of, I guess it's probably like a CGI argument or something like that. I don't really know. But to find this out, you can fire up another instance of Conqueror and go to Antia.com and do a search. Do a search for FUBAR, and it will take you to the search result page, and this is the stuff that you need to know. So in the URL bar, just ignore the search results. In the URL bar, you should see http://www.antya.com/antsearch.php?s=FUBAR. And then some, like, x equals 0 and y equals 0. That's, that we don't care about. The really important part is the Antia.com, because that's the top-level domain, or whatever it's called. I sounded like I really understood networking there for a moment, didn't I? And then it says antsearch.php, which is the instance of that page. And then the question mark s equals. Okay, so since the question mark s equals FUBAR, we can ascertain pretty easily that the question s equals FUBAR is basically identifying to the browser what the search term was, right? So if you search for the bad apples and do it again, then the URL is going to be antia.com/antsearch.php?s=what? Yes, the bad apples. So if you search for your name, Klaatu, then it would be antia.com/antsearch.php?s=Klaatu. So you get the hang of this, right? So that's the part that you need. You can forget basically everything after the equal sign. So you just need to copy and paste the http://www.antia.com/antsearch.php?s=, and that's it. Do not take the search term. You don't want the search term. You want to leave the search term open, because that's what you're doing when you type into that search box. So copy that and paste that into the search URI. Now, if we said that's it, that's all we want to do, KDE is going to give us an error, because it requires a variable after the equal sign. So the variable that they choose to use is a backslash, curly bracket, and then the at symbol, and then a closed curly bracket. Technically speaking, you can change this variable, but the recommended one is the at sign, because I guess that interferes less with your search, and I guess you can do some fancy stuff with it, and I wouldn't even know how to begin doing that or what we would do, so I just did a backslash, curly bracket, at, close curly bracket. So the complete URI is http://www.antia.com/antsearch.php?s=backslash, curly bracket, at, sign, close curly bracket. And that's it. You're going to be amazed at what happens. So the URI shortcut, this again is just if you don't want to click into that search bar, you can just type in some, you know, this shortcut, colon, and then the search term, and Conqueror knows to use the Antia search for that. So I gave that AY because I figured that was something I could remember. And that's it. So you say okay. And now if you make sure that that is selected, and it even picks up the little fave icon, you know, it's got a little A there now in your search bar, and then you can type in something. Let's type in FUBAR again. Well, let's type something that we didn't use yet, so FUBAS. And then we say return, and sure enough, it takes us to the Antia page with all the results of FUBAS on that page. And now, just to make sure that we're really, really in the clear, let's search for GORT from the little search box again. And sure enough, it takes us to a new Antia.antsearch.php page with GORT results. So we're good. We're good to go. We've just changed. We've just introduced a completely brand new search engine to our little search bar, and it is indeed a free and open source search bar, which is just really cool. So I hope that helped. I think that we deserve a cup of coffee for that, don't you? Let's have one. Okay, I have to confess I lied. I can't have a cup of coffee because I'm sitting out in the park. But you, please, don't let this hold you up. Go get a cup of coffee. Enjoy it. Have one for me, as they say. And then we'll come right back to the rest of the show. Alright, that was, I'm sure, very good coffee. I imagined I was having a cup with you, so... very good, I'm sure. I wanted to talk actually a little bit about WPA Supplicant, because I've had a little bit of experience with it lately, because I've been around all kinds of networks lately. I've just been, well, I'll tell you, I'm not going to get internet for myself. Like I say, I've moved, and let's just suffice it to say that I'm not going to be getting any internet service. For myself, because I figure it's everywhere. You know, you've got internet available to you everywhere. So, especially in the sort of lifestyle that I'm living right now, I'm just out a lot at different places. So, or I'm at work and they have internet there. So, between, you know, sitting at a job for half a day and then another job for a quarter of the day and then just out at an internet cafe for the rest of the day and evening, you don't really, you know, I find that it's not really, I'm not going to really be, I don't need the internet for myself. I can leech off of others. So I've been encountering a lot of different networks, which is interesting because, I mean, I guess I've encountered lots of networks before, but in this case, I'm noticing a lot of different things about them. And absurdly, I'm carrying around 3 laptops in my backpack, which is ridiculous, and I realize this, and I don't know why I'm doing it. Well, I do know why. One is my precious Lenovo. It's a fantastic laptop. I love it, and I can't part with it, so I don't want it ever out of my possession. Plus, it's got all my data, my real data on it, so... That's my work laptop. The other one is a new Acer Aspire that I acquired. Aspire 1, rather. So that's the little netbook. Yes, I know it's kind of silly to carry a netbook around, plus my Lenovo. I mean, that's why bother with a netbook in that case. The point of the netbook is that you can just grab it and go, right? I don't know. I'm having too much fun with it right now. I don't necessarily want to not have it. Plus, the Acer Aspire 1's battery... was apparently dead. I got it from someone else, and it seemed like the battery was completely dead. I would plug it in, it would claim to be charging, and then I would take it out, and it would not be charging. So that was a big problem, so I ordered a new battery. Not only did its battery magically come back to life, but the new battery that I got for it was one of those extended batteries. It lasts forever. So I have 2 batteries for this thing, and the thing just won't die. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. The thing is marvelous. It's running Slackware 13 right now, 32-bit. It's an Atom processor. It's a lot snappier than my triple E PC was. It's a 1.6 gigahertz chip, for crying out loud. It's about as fast as, you know, like a MacBook that I used to have. So, I mean, it's a really nice little machine. It's running marvelously. It's got a great little chipset for the graphics, apparently, because it sure does just, it pumps out the graphics, the K-Win effects and stuff. It's great. The keyboard's nice and big. The hard drive is not solid state, so it's quite large. I'm really impressed with it. So that's my netbook now. The triple E PC I gave to my friend Scarlett. So she's running Slackware on there now. Oops, I mean Fedora. So then the other one I have is my test Toshiba laptop, which is a horrible laptop. I hate it. I despise it. The graphics suck on it. It's just horrible. But it's a great little test machine for all my Slack builds and for my Slacker media experimentation and stuff like that. So plus it's an AMD chip, which I'd never had before. So I was kind of, I'm always interested in just kind of seeing any kind of difference between compiling something on my Lenovo versus the Toshiba versus the Aspire. So the Trilogy, the 3 of them are kind of like my Slacker media test bed, sort of, with the Lenovo actually being my real machine. But the other 2 are kind of like interesting comparative laptops. So I'm carrying them all around. So each of them has a different wireless chip in it, amazingly enough. I mean, it couldn't have worked out better. So they each have a different wireless chip, and so it's really, and I'm going to all different kinds of networks, the public Wi-Fi networks, not necessarily public, but they are different Wi-Fi networks. And so I'm really getting to experience a whole slew of different interactions with different routers, different setups, all this other stuff. I want to talk about both IWList a little bit, and Wicked a little bit, and WPA Supplicant. So let's start, I guess, with IWList. So IWList, I don't really know what it is or where it comes from. I've just kind of known it ever since my Fedora on the iBook days, because that was how I finally got online with Fedora and the iBook. And so IWList is this great little application that you usually need to be root to execute. And what it does is it gives you all kinds of information about the data that's flying around you, even now. We just don't know it. So if you do like a sudo or, you know, su-c quote IWList WLAN0, for instance, if your wireless card is WLAN0, and then say scan, then, and close quote if you're doing the SUW-C rather, and the IWList WLAN0 scan will basically talk to your little wireless card. And this is assuming that you've got a known working wireless card, by the way. So it talks to your wireless card and says, hey, just do a scan of everything flying around you, everything that you could potentially connect to. Do a scan of that and list everything that you see for me. So you may, at any different location, get a really, really long list of a billion different wireless networks that are in your area, you know, if you're in the middle of the city, or the middle of the suburbs where everyone around you has their own little wireless router. Or you may get nothing, which I would get right now if I did that, because I'm at a city park. So this is a very useful command, and you've probably seen this kind of list before, for instance, in your network manager, whether it's like the little GNOME network manager applet that like Fedora uses, or whether it's Wicked, WICD, or whatever, or IWList. So that's what those things are using, presumably on the back end, but they usually give you a lot less information. IWList itself gives you all kinds of useful information, and just to give you an example, it will list the channel that the signal is on. It will give you the ESSID, which is more commonly known as like the network name or the router, what the router's called or something like that. You know, usually they call it, I think, network name is what they usually list that as. So if you've ever opened up your wireless little network manager, you know, and you see all these like Linksys 4586, Linksys B12A2, you know, all those like default names of routers, because all people do is like plug them in. That's the ESSID. If you've named your network OMG Ponies, then when people drive by your apartment, they, you know, and they're war driving or something, they'll see OMG Ponies. But that's what the ESSID is, and for whatever reason, the technical term for that is ESSID. Okay, so you'll also get the actual, well, they refer to it as AP, which is access point. So it's like the MAC address of the actual router, which is interesting. And it gives you the signal strength and the signal-to-noise ratio, all that kind of information. So if you're really, really, I mean, if you've just got like 20 different choices and you just want to make sure that you've got like the fastest, best connection possible, you could do an IWList WLAN0 scan. And keep in mind, well, let me finish this thought first. And you can see all of the different information. You can see what channel they're on, what the signal-to-noise ratio is, the strength of the signal, all that other stuff right there in your terminal. If you have scroll enabled, you know, if you can scroll back, or if you pipe it into a text file and just look at it, you can really see, you can really just micromanage and see which one's the absolute best signal. So that's what IWList FUBAR scan does. And I say FUBAR because you should, of course, be aware that your wireless card isn't necessarily called WLAN0. It kind of depends. One of my computers calls it WLAN0. The other one calls it ETH1, with ETH0 being the Ethernet card. So it just kind of depends. And the way that you figure that out, typically, is do either an IW config, which, again, you have to be root to do that. IW config should list all the wireless interfaces available to you. If you don't see anything there, you either don't have a wireless card or you don't have the driver to your wireless card running properly. So you need to investigate how to do that. That's IW list. Now, what do you do with all that information? Well, it's just a series of IW config commands and if config commands. So the first thing you could do is, well, make sure that your interface is up, your little wireless card is up. But if you've been able to do an IW list, it is. But if you're just starting out, then you might want to do like an if config WLAN0 up, and then that would bring that interface to life. So once you've done the IW list WLAN0, for instance, scan, you've got your list of networks, and let's say that you choose one, an open network, so you're not going to be cracking into anything, although if you need to, there's instructions all over the place online, including one by Cobra 2, which you know Cobra 2, perhaps from UnixPorn.com, from, what else has he been on? Well, he's been on Hacker Public Radio, he's been on some other show, the instance is escaping me. I think he called in once to, like, Linux Cranks or something. But anyway, Cobra 2, he's a good guy. Know him well. You've got the IW list there with an open network, for instance, showing up. Let's say it's called OMG Ponies. Okay, so there's OMG Ponies, which is someone's network, and it's open. It's free to join, so you decide you're going to go ahead and join this open network that's called OMG Ponies. I don't know if I'd do that myself, but let's say that you know where you are, and you know that you're fine with joining that network. So the way to do that is IW config WLAN0. That's the syntax. It's IW config is the command, and then WLAN0 is the interface that you're going to be talking about. And this is all having to be done by as root, by the way. And then you want to associate your wireless card with a network. So you put in ESSID space, quote, OMG Ponies, end quote. You don't have to put the quotes if it's one word, but if they had put a space between OMG and the word ponies, then you would have to do quotes to encapsulate that space. And then you hit return, and it returns zero if it's successful. So it should just say nothing. It should just give you a command prompt back. That means it worked. You can confirm that it worked by doing an IW config again and looking at what ESSID it has now assigned to WLAN0. Assuming that works, you may be able to, at this point, do either a DHCPCD space WLAN0. That is DHCPCD space WLAN0. And that is just starting up the little DHCP requesting daemon specifically for WLAN0. Now, if your system doesn't use that, you might be using DH client. So you would put in DH client space WLAN0, and that will probe the network that it's been assigned to, and should request the IP address, and then it should work. Now, I've experienced in some situations, and I'm not sure why, but I think this might be because there are a number of, let's say, OMG Ponies. So if I'm at a company and it's called OMG Ponies, and they've got like three routers set up, you know, three access points with the name OMG Ponies on it. And I've seen this at large cafes where they'll literally, because they know that people are going to come in there and sit on their wireless all day long. So they've got like lots of different places that you can get into or get onto their network from. But they're all called OMG Ponies. So sometimes I have found, and I think it might be because the routers are all called the same thing, perhaps, but I will request an IP address, and I just won't get it. It just says none available or none offered, you know, something like that. I know that, you know, it should be working. What I've found is that assigning, you know, specifying which router I want to point my card at helps. Actually solves the problem. It doesn't just help, but it works. So the command to do that would be IW config WLAN0 AP, and then again in quotes, just to encapsulate everything, I like to do that. And then you paste in the MAC address of the router, and you get the MAC address again from the listing for AP, and it looks like a MAC address, in the IW list WLAN scan 0 WLAN 0 scan output. You'll find the OMG Ponies that you want to use, the channel that it's on, and the AP. You know, it says AP, and then it gives you this MAC address. So you just paste that in, close quotes, and hit return again. And again, it's going to return 0 on success, so it should just give you a command prompt again. Again, you can verify it with IW config if you want to. And then again, you do the DHCPCD WLAN 0 or the DH client WLAN 0, and it should request an IP address from that specific router, and now you should get an IP address, and you should be online. Now, this is all assuming, you know, we're doing this from the command line because we're assuming for the moment that for whatever reason our network manager isn't working. And interestingly enough, it seems that certain networks with certain cards, and if I was a scientist, I would be noting exactly all the details of this, but I really don't know what kind of router these are. I suspect these are Apple AirPorts, but I can't be sure because I don't know. But it's a very, this particular network that I've been having problems on has, it's been a very Apple-centric network, and that's why I'm kind of just assuming off the cuff that it's an Apple AirPort network. Again, I could be wrong. It could be completely something different. It could be Cisco, for all I know. Although it's probably not, because I do know that there's a Cisco network that I go to that works as expected. So whatever it is, this one specific network just won't be recognized by the Intel, I think it's the Intel chip. No, I'm sorry, it's not the Intel chip. It's the Atheros chip in the Acer Aspire 1, I believe. I'd have to check on that too, but pretty sure it's the Atheros chip in the Acer Aspire 1. Just it won't see the access points that I know are out there. The only way I can get it to actually give me that back is doing it via IWList WLAN0 scan. And that lists the access points that I know are there. But if I just try to do it through, for instance, Wicked or some other graphical network manager, it does not list them. And that is even if I try to, you know, on Wicked you can add a hidden network so that if you know the network exists, you can kind of add it, and it still doesn't work. So I have to do it through the IWList scan, I have to do it through IWConfig, and it works perfectly. Okay, so that's one scenario. Yet another network with, actually, again, a lot of different routers to choose from, but this one distinguishes them with a number at the end of the name. So it's FUBAR, you know, the ESS ID is always FUBAR, but then it's just _1, _2, _3. And it is WEP protected, which, yeah, you can scoff all you want and say WEP. No one uses WEP anymore. It's only got like a 12-digit, 12-alphanumeric password, 12-character alphanumeric password. So it's not a complex network, and yet the, let me think if I can remember what kind of chip this one is. I think it is a, I don't remember. It might be a Broadcom chip. It just will not. It will not sign in to this this network, which is very, very strange. I mean, I'm using Wicked. I'm typing in everything that I need to. It just doesn't work. And then I'll do it manually from the command line and type in everything that I need to, and it doesn't work. Apparently, whatever encryption scheme they're using for the web needs to be dealt with through WPA supplicant. A WPA supplicant, of course, is that little daemon or process that can run in the background, but typically we're not really used to seeing it because it's being used in the back end. Wicked, for instance, can use it as its WPA engine, let's call it. So, you know, that you're using it a lot of times if you're signing into WPA networks or WPA2 networks, but you're not aware of it. And apparently this WEP network, I tried it all day long, and it just would not work. And forgive me if I've covered this before. I think I wrote a blog post about it. But you need to go into the wpasupplicant.conf file in /etc, again as root, and actually add all the information in to the WPA supplicant file. Put in the name of the network. You need to put in the fact that it's encrypted with WEP, I believe, and then the WEP password you need to enter into there. And it's a really odd thing, and it feels strange, and you have to fire up WPA supplicant from the command line to be able to use this WEP network. But it works beautifully, and I'm not going to go through the different commands for that, because that's one of those things that if you ever encounter this, I think, very strange and very sort of niche issue, you can look it up online. And I also wrote a blog about it, which I will, which I can link to somewhere on the page, on the Bad Apple site. So I'm not going to go through all the stuff because it's pretty mundane. It's just the fact that you have to use WPA supplicant in order to get to the WEP network that I'd never experienced, and like 5 or 6 people in the Slackware IRC channel had never experienced. So it was really an unusual problem, and I was really quite surprised at the eventual answer that I found with enough looking around online. And of course, part of the problem is always in those kinds of cases, you don't know what the problem is. You don't know what you're supposed to be searching for. All you know is that you can't get onto a network. So you start diagnosing the chipset, you start making sure you've got the right driver, you're making sure that you haven't screwed up your configuration somehow, you know, you installed Slackware wrong. What's the issue? And the issue ends up being something really obscure, like, I need to use WPA supplicant in order to get onto a WEP network. How do you know to search for that? Well, you don't. So it's something that really comes around after a lot of, like, trial and error, basically. So I'll link to the details on that if you ever need it. So that's fun with networks, I guess. It's been really interesting going to just lots and lots of different networks. I've got like two different jobs with their networks. I've got a lot of different like cafes and places that I'll go to sit in to get online there. So it's been interesting, and the whole equation of, okay, I'm on an open network, just exactly how much do I want to do on this network, you know? That's been an interesting thing as well, and I've been messing around with some server-based solutions with Deep Geek from Talk Geek to Me podcast and Lost in Bronx from Hacker Public Radio. We all kind of have been playing around with this idea of being able to be out and about, but to have somewhere that you can actually SSH into, so that if you need to do something that actually matters to you, like check your email and stuff like that, you can do that without exposing any information that you don't want to be exposing over a public network. So that's another topic for another segment entirely, but hopefully this has been somewhat informative in terms of network problems and where to look and where to go to solve them. Okay, that's about it for this episode, I think, actually. This has been episode 12 of season 5. I've been Klaatu. In fact, I still am Klaatu. You can reach me online a variety of ways. TheBadApple.info always gets you to me. Klaatu@HackerPublicRadio.org gets you to me. IRC, my nickname on there, is not Klaatu. No longer is it Klaatu. I know, I think I announced one episode that I'd gotten a name simply Klaatu, but someone messaged me on Freenode and said, hey, you took my nick, can I have it back? So I relinquished the nick Klaatu, so I'm again not Klaatu, but that was okay. I was really getting used to not Klaatu anyway. So Jabber, I'm also not Klaatu at jabber.org, and I think that's about it. So that's how to contact me, and otherwise you can contact me in person at either Southeast Linux Fest or FOSCON. So have a great week, and I will talk to you next time.
Because I think boys are fun.